Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for coming to this session. I believe it's the last of the day. Is that right? So congratulations. Thank you guys for coming out. I really appreciate it. My name is Wade Wegner, and I'm a technical evangelist for Salesforce. I focus largely on our developer experience, which is one of the reasons why I'm going to be talking about how we built an SDK for .NET developers today. Just to give you some background about myself, I actually used to be at Microsoft. I was at Microsoft on the, well, I guess now it's called Microsoft Azure team for quite a while, and then left and did some consulting, and somehow wound up at Salesforce. So it's been a pretty exciting journey. So one of the things that I want to mention is, throughout this talk, I'm going to be building actually a brand new SDK. So I figure demonstrating how this works. Is a lot better than a whole bunch of slides. So I'm going to be building out a brand new SDK, and I will be committing it and putting it right up in GitHub. So no need to ask if any of this will be available when the session's over, because it's literally all going to be up in GitHub. So definitely you can check it out, and this is where I'll be committing it. So I'm going to start first by showing you the actual SDK that we built and we've released. I want to give you guys a glimpse of what this can look like and what it can do first. And then what we'll do is we'll step back and we'll talk about some of the important concepts. And we'll, honestly, what we're going to do is we're going to walk through all the learning that I encountered when I ended up building out this SDK. And we're going to do it by going through it one piece at a time. So without further ado, let me go ahead and show you some of this. So one of the most important parts about the SDK is to make sure it's easy for people to get. Easy for people to use. So what I'm going to do is do a brand new project and show you how you can acquire the SDK using NuGet and pretty much get started. Now, the SDK itself is built as a portable class library, which means it works on a number of different platforms. So we can build a Windows Phone app, a Windows 8 app, and so forth. So I'm just going to show this first using a Windows Phone app. So there's a number of different dependencies between the SDK, and it's important to chain your dependencies appropriately. What I'm going to end up doing is installing a sample which chains a couple of different things, and I'll show you them in here. Show you them in a moment. So developerforce dot Windows Phone, and then sample. Excuse me. I think Windows Phone 8 dot sample dot account. And so what this does is it's going to grab all the needed dependencies, including a NuGet that manages the OAuth login process, and an additional set of dependencies which actually manage the interactions between the application and the Salesforce APIs. So if we take a look at our packages config, you'll end up seeing that we've got this developerforce.common and force. Those are the base libraries within the SDK. These are the things that talk directly to the REST APIs. But what we also have is this login and samples.account. And the login is another NuGet that is specific to this platform that will enable us to facilitate this login experience. So once you install those NuGets, there's a couple of things that you update that NuGet really can't do for you. The first thing is we're going to change the page that gets loaded. So we'll go pages, and I believe it's just login. Let's double check. Yep, login page. So that way, when the phone app opens, it's going to go directly to the login page. Now, in order to interact with Salesforce, and if you guys do any Salesforce development, you probably know this already, you need to have a connected app. And that actually facilitates this login experience. And the connected app gives you some keys that you'll end up using. So let's go ahead and grab those keys. I'm going to log in to my Salesforce instance. I've already got a connected app created. So what I'm going to do is go to that connected app and grab the consumer key. And it should just take a moment here. So I've got this connected app already. I'm going to go ahead and grab that consumer key. And again, this consumer key is used to identify my instance of Salesforce, the one that I want to connect with. So I've got the consumer key. We've got some other things in here. I'm also going to update, and when I'm done, I'm going to end up loading an additional page. I'm going to load, instead of the main page, I'm going to load accounts page.xaml. And after making those updates, we should be ready to go. So I'm going to go ahead and fire up the emulator, and we'll take a look at this application running. As it's loading, I want to point out, I'm not really going deep into some of the interactions and the way this API works. And this is one of the nice things about building great developer SDKs, is you can enable a developer to do what they need to do faster, rather than making them actually have to traverse the entire API service and manage those REST calls themselves. So let me go ahead and log in. And you'll be able to see the password, but that's all right. I'm not worried about it. We'll log in. We're going to go ahead and allow access. And if all works, we should see our list of accounts. And there they are. So pretty, I think, good demonstration of how quickly using an SDK and a set of NuGets and so forth, you can build out an application experience on a platform that is able to manage most of that interaction for you. And to hopefully drive this home a little bit more, what I want to do is flip over to my Mac. And another thing that we're going to talk about as we build out this SDK is the importance of making sure that this runs not only on multiple Microsoft platforms, but you want to have it run on as many platforms as possible. And what's great about these portable class libraries and using Mono.net is you have the ability to build these PCLs that then you can use, package up in NuGets, and then use up on the Mac, either using Mono.net directly or tools such as Xamarin that allow you to take C# code and build iOS and Android apps. So it takes a little bit longer to build this, so I'm not going to do it from scratch. But if you notice here in my packages.config file, you'll see the same NuGet packages, right? developerforce.common and developerforce.force. I'm going to go ahead and run this. And this uses a slightly different auth flow that I'll talk about in a moment. So I won't have to log in because it's using username passwords. But you can see here now that it's queried the organization and it's pulled back a set of accounts. So that's a quick look at the SDK that we built. What I want to do is just quickly point out a couple of other things. So it's important with these SDKs, at least in my opinion, to make sure that these are open source and available. So we try to do everything we can to develop and build these SDKs out in the open. So all the source code is up here and available, including samples, including the full source, as well as even our NuGet packaging information. So, I mean, all we try to keep from here is certain keys that might, you know, let someone else, you know, get into something. But everything else is here. And so if you know, it's a very active community, and I think it's important to build this active community around these open source projects. So that's a quick look at kind of the end state of building this SDK. So before I actually get into the agenda and we start building this out from scratch, one thing I do want to announce is that I'm very happy. We're going to be contributing our SDK to the .NET Foundation. So once I think the paperwork is done, so it's going to happen. It's just a matter of now when we get things updated. But it's really great. And I think this is a fantastic foundation that Microsoft has put together. For us, whom are all presumably .NET developers, to be able to have a great place to go that's full of .NET projects all in open source is a great thing. So I'm very excited to have this contributed. So this is today's agenda. This is what we're going to walk through and the things that we're going to talk on. Now, this is a 300-level talk, I believe. I don't plan to really explain all the 101 level stuff around PCLs or async await. What I want to do is talk to you about it from the perspective of us building an SDK that developers use and why these things are important and, you know, some of the things to think about. And so I did this in segments and chunks so that in segment one, we'll build the beginning part of our SDK and we're going to focus on the things that are listed in there. So PCLs, extensibility, async await, and so forth. And so we'll walk through it, and by the end, we should have a fully functional SDK that we not only have up in GitHub for everyone to use, but we'll even create a NuGet and deploy it. So let's start with segment one without any further ado. All right, so let me close down some of this other stuff that I had. And we're going to start from a file new project. But I mentioned that we're going to put this all up in GitHub, so when I start a new project, I tend to like to start from GitHub and then clone locally. So we're going to call this Tech Ed 14 SDK. How's that? We'll initialize it. I'm going to talk through some of the things. Like, I think it's very important that you start this off with, you know, certain things like making sure you're using the right gitignore so that it doesn't have a whole bunch of the, you know, temporary files getting committed in. And we'll talk a little bit more at the end about this, but I think choosing the right license is also very important, making sure that, you know, you are creating the right license for the kind and style of open source project that you want to be facilitating. So we'll go ahead and create that. I'm going to grab the SSH URL, and then what I'll do is I'll come in here, and I'm just going to go ahead and clone it. And so this is going to provide us kind of the start and the base of our project. It's going to give us a home for everything else to be built. So what I'm going to start off then now is I'm going to create a source folder, and all our code is going to live in the source folder, because we're going to have other things that are going to live in the top level. So we'll create that source folder. I'm going to grab the path, and now we can create our project. When we create our project, we're going to start off by creating the actual library that developers are going to use to interact with our API. So there's a type, I believe, introduced, gosh, I think there was some extensibility or v6 you could install for .NET 4.0, but pretty much from like .NET 4.5 on, these PCLs have been, you know, part of the framework and just been, you know, a fantastic resource for us. So we're going to choose that PCL class library, make sure that we specify the location to our source folder, and I'm going to call this salesforce.force, and go ahead and create that. Now this is when this is a topic worth spending a little bit of time on. Basically, at this point now we're choosing what we want to target. You know, when we build this SDK and we want other people to use it, what platforms are they going to use in order to when they build apps? Are they going to be building Windows Phone apps? Is it important for them and for your customers or your developers to be building Silverlight apps? You know, and so forth. To a degree, it's a trade-off here, because what a PCL does is it ends up breaking down certain capabilities and pieces of functionality to a common level so that it works across all these different platforms. And so there are going to be trade-offs. On MSDN, there's a great matrix of features across the different target frameworks. And so you'll want to spend some time looking at, you know, what features you're going to need as part of your library and then what platforms that you want to target. For me, I wanted to make sure that we targeted some of the more common and modern languages. So, you know, starting at .NET 4.5 works fine, but I want to make sure that it works in Windows 8 and it works in Windows Phone. And I also want to make sure that there's great support for Mono.NET. And I spent quite a bit of time with some folks on the Xamarin team. And although this guidance changes, and by the, you know, if you watch this later in video or if there's anyone else watching this, this advice may not be the same, but what I decided is to choose a target profile called Profile 78. And I'll show you that in a moment when we create that, where you'll see Profile 78. But 78 has been kind of the go-to target profile for building these cross-platform libraries for a little while, probably the last 6 months. Again, this could change in the future, but you want to make sure to spend some time thinking about the target frameworks that you select at this stage. It is worth noting that you can change these later. In fact, when I started this project for Salesforce, I had a different target profile selected. So you can make changes later. You're not going to end up getting stuck in a particular PCL target. So go ahead and click OK, and it's going to create a project. I'm going to first unload it so that I can just point out a couple of things in this project that I think are interesting. So let's unload and then edit it. I mentioned target profile 78, so you can see here target framework profile 78. So this is one way you can take a look. It's interesting that in the Visual Studio experience, it doesn't really surface the target profile number up to us. You can look at it this way. When you flip over to the Mac, and if you're using the Xamarin tools, they actually do a really good job of telling you what the profile number is. But this is one way that you can look at it from Visual Studio. Let's go and reload this. All right, so we got a base project. The first thing we're going to work on is our authentication, so which I think is reasonable for most APIs. So authentication client. It's a little cold up here. My fingers are going to have a hard time typing, I think. So we've got our authentication client. We're going to start off by creating a constructor. And we're going to be using the HTTP client quite a bit. So HTTP client is a PCL that's delivered as a NuGet. So we can install this directly from Microsoft. It's called microsoft.net.http. And we're going to install it into our project. And now we can end up using the HTTP client for doing all of our REST calls. So I'm going to create an HTTP client. And we're going to create a field that's going to keep track of that for us. So now that we've got that client, so that's going to be part of the constructor. And so now let's create our first method that developers will use. And we're going to call this the username password async method. Salesforce has a number of different authentication flows. So you can use a username password flow if you just want to put the username password in. There's a web server flow where you don't actually have the username and password in code and so on and so forth. So in the full SDK, we have support for all of those methods. Here what we're going to do is we're just going to implement the username password flow. So we're going to have a public async, and I'll get to async in a moment, task username password async. And it's going to take some information that we pass in. So we're going to have a string client ID, string client secret, username, and password. So async, I want to talk just a moment about. There's a number of reasons for wanting to have your SDK support the async and await pattern. It's a deep topic. There's plenty of literature out there. The main driving forces for me choosing this is, one is I wanted to make sure that that developers using this had the ability to use this in a non-blocking way. So let's say you're developing, and particularly if you're developing for like Windows Phone or Windows 8, where you have to be asynchronous, it's important that you don't end up blocking other interactions, UI threads and so forth with, you know, let's say you're making a query to update a grid. If that query and that operation takes a while, let's say you're pulling in thousands of records, you don't want to block the user interface, right? You don't want to make that a poor experience for the user. So it's important to let these things be asynchronous so that later on you can end up buying that data and refresh. So that's largely the main reason for it. So you'll find in our SDK, and I suspect in many of the SDKs being built, developers are using this async pattern more often. You can use this in a synchronous pattern as well if you need to, which is another nice part about it. The other thing that's nice about async await is the syntax is fantastic. It looks like you're writing synchronous code, and it lets the compiler do all the hard work for you. So we have our username password method. Now, there's going to be a fair amount of stuff that we're going to use here. So I've got a little snippet, and we'll walk through, what this is. So the first part that we have here is we've got some content that we're going to pass as part of our request call. And that's going to be our client ID, our secret, our username, password, all that information we passed into the method. We want to take that information and then essentially construct an HTTP message out of it and end up posting it to our endpoint. Now, our endpoint is going to be defined by some sort of URL. So I'm going to go ahead and add that URL. For Salesforce, it ends up being this particular URL. But the reason to have it as a separate variable, and we'll get to it in a moment, is depending on your circumstances, you may be authenticating against a different endpoint. And you want to provide some level of extensibility for your user. So we've got the URL. We're creating our HTTP request, and we end up posting the content to it. Next we want to do is we want to handle the response, right? And this is a REST API, and it's going to end up being we're going to interact with it via JSON. So we're going to use a JSON package called newtonsoft.json. And that's going to manage the serialization of JSON between JSON and CLR objects for us. So we're deserializing it into this auth token. So let's go ahead and create that class. And you'll see that the auth token has a bunch of information that we get back from Salesforce. And we're going to grab some of it and store it. I'll get to that in a moment. And then we also, if things fail, we can get an error response. And so let's go ahead and create that error response class as well. And the last pieces here are the auth token and the instance URL. Once the authentication is complete, some of the information passed back to us are pieces of information we want to use with subsequent requests. So if we go to make a query against our API, or if we want to end up creating some additional things, we need to have an access token, and we need to know what instance URL to point to. So we want to create these actually as public properties attached to the class. So what I'm going to do now is go ahead and add a couple of public properties here called instance URL access token. And we can use these later on in order to get the data that was passed back to us during that authentication process. So at this point, our authentication client is actually pretty complete. We have the ability now to interact with our API to authenticate with this username password flow, and we'll get this payload response back. The one other thing I wanted to talk about, though, is extensibility. One of the things you may have noticed here is in our constructor, we're newing up an HTTP client. So every time we end up wanting to authenticate, we're going to create a new HTTP client. That may be fine for most cases, but there's going to be some cases where you want to have the ability to extend it, to pass in your own HTTP client. You may want to, you know, change something in the request headers, or you may want to use the same HTTP client across many different calls for performance reasons. So it's important to have in our SDK a number of different overloads of our constructor so that we have some flexibility that our users can use. Same thing goes for this token request endpoint, that URL that you see here. In Salesforce, you may end up having what's called a sandbox instance, which is a version of your production Salesforce account, but it's used in sandbox so that if you're doing development or you're testing some things, you don't impact production and your end users, which is an important thing. And when you use the sandbox, you have a different URL. You actually hit test.salesforce.com. So if we just left it like this, we would make it very difficult for our users to authenticate. So the next thing I wanted to highlight is just the importance of having, the importance of having additional, what am I doing wrong? Constructors. I spelled authentication incorrectly. Fantastic. All right, let's fix that real quick. We want to have a number of different constructors here, right? So you can see this first constructor is pretty much like what we had before. It's just anytime you new up this class, it's going to create a new client, and it's going to use this default login. Here we can pass in an HTTP client. Here we can pass in a URL. Here we can pass in both. So that's important so that we give some of this flexibility to our users. So at this point, our authentication client, especially now that we've spelled it correctly, is complete. We're going to flip over to the next segment, and first let me kind of highlight what we're going to talk about in this next segment. Very early on when I started building the SDKs, and kind of as it's highlighted here, I don't have a way to actually test what I built. Right, I've got this authentication class now that theoretically logs us in, and the code looks correct, but who knows? And so I'm going to spend some time not only talking, but then building out some functional tests and unit tests. And I think there's a lot of different ways to define this. I don't know if I define them correctly or not, but the way I think about it is with the functional tests, I'm actually going to be interacting with our API and essentially testing that the interaction between the client that I've written and the API and the responses back is what I expect, because that's important. Whereas with unit tests, I'm actually going to be testing the code that I've written and making sure that the code that I've written functions the way that I expect it to work. And so I break it out across these two things, functional tests and unit tests. I could see a lot of good arguments for pulling them together and making them consistent. So, you know, there's a lot of opportunities to have some variance here, but that's the way that I think about it at least. And so I'll go ahead and show you how we'll do this. So we're going to create a new project. Now, this project is going to be our unit test project, so it does not need to be a PCL. What we're going to create, interesting. So I didn't notice I created the PCL from Windows Phone. This will be an experiment. I've never done it that way before. I assume that it's the same project type, so we'll see. I'm going to go back here to Windows and just create now a class library. And this one I'm going to call Salesforce.force. Dot functional tests. Live demos are always so fun. Let's go ahead and rename this to tests so that this represents our tests. And then I'm going to use NUnit for all our testing. I think NUnit is a well-established testing framework. So we're going to install it to the wrong one. So now what we do is we're going to create this as a test fixture. And we'll create our first test. And we'll see if that PCL works or not. So this is going to be a public async task. And let's call this one auth username password has token. So basically, we're gonna log in and make sure that we get a token back. So we'll say var auth equals new authentication client. And we'll add a reference to our project. And now what we're going to do is we're going to await, because this is an asynchronous method, so we're going to await auth.username password async, and we're going to pass in client ID, client secret, username, and password. And let's go ahead and got these. So I base64 encoded them, so no one got any smart ideas. Try to play around with the demo. And after we've awaited this, let's go ahead and actually do an assertion and see if we got the token back that we expected. So we'll go assert is not null for our access token. And I'll go ahead and put a breakpoint here so we can see what happens. And we'll run it. And there you can see that we actually got an access token back. In fact, if we look at our authentication client here, you'll see that we also got our token, our instance URL as well. So we know now that this authentication client works. We can actually authenticate using this flow. So that's good. So that's an example of one of our functional tests. Now, if you look at RSDK, you'll see there's certainly a whole lot more functional tests, particularly around authentication. But I think this gives you an idea as to what to do for authentication or for functional testing. We're going to create one more project here. And this one's going to be what I call our unit test. We'll call this salesforce.force.unittests. And like before, we're going to use NUnit. Call this tests. All right, so this time what we're going to do is we're going to test fixture. We're going to test the interaction. We're going to test our library itself. So we have another thing in Salesforce with all our APIs called the Salesforce version. And so we have a way to version all our APIs so that as we release new functionality and capabilities, we don't end up breaking existing deployments, breaking existing integrations, and breaking existing apps. So I want to give people the ability to not only specify, but know which API version they're using. So let's go ahead and create a test that tests this interaction. So we'll say async task. This will be auth has API version. And then we'll new up our authentication client. Add the reference. And then let's just assert is not null auth.api version. Now, I haven't created it. So this is a good example of like almost a TDD approach, right? Because I want to first check to see. I have a failing test, obviously, because I can't compile it. So let's go here and add that. So we'll add a new property of type string. And we'll call this API version. And probably what you'd want to do is create another set of overloads so you can specify that API version. But since this is a demo, I'll just end up saying that API version equals version 29. All right? So now when I come back to our test, you'll see that it passes. If I run this, and it aborted. Let's try running it again. Public tests. Oh, I didn't annotate this. Apologies. All right, let's try it now. Run that, and there we go. So let's just run everything, see we all our tests pass. So that's pretty good. So, you know, here's an example now. We have our functional tests and we have our unit tests. And of course, you'd want to put a lot more in there, but here's a good example. Now, in the next segment, I'm going to be moving over to the Mac. I'm going to be showing a couple of things. So what I want to do is go ahead and commit all this stuff into our repository. So let's add this up here. Initial commit. And all right, so we've pushed it. So now when we flip over in a moment, we can get access to this code. And the next thing I want to talk about is the Mono.NET and Xamarin, as well as continuous integration. I think it's fair to say that iOS and Android have a good market share. So a lot of developers who are .NET developers may want to build apps for iOS and for Android applications. I think that's a very fair premise. One thing that Xamarin Mono.NET does a fantastic job of is providing support to .NET developers so that they can build on these other platforms. Mono.NET's been doing it for years with Linux, and you know, having the support for Android and iOS is pretty powerful. So I wanted to make sure that our developers, if they were C#.NET developers, and if they needed to build an integration into Salesforce on an iOS or an Android device, they had the ability to do so. So supporting Mono.NET was very important. So I'll show some of the things that I ended up doing in order to get this to work. At the same time, I want to talk a little bit about continuous integration. And you'll see why in a moment. When you're building an SDK, it's very important that you have continual insight into the health of the published SDK. Early on, I ended up using a service provided by TeamCity, I used TeamCity running in a Windows Azure VM. And that worked really well, but it also ended up costing me money. So I ended up looking at another service, and I'll show you this service called Travis CI. The service you use is not as important, I think, as the fact that you have some sort of CI process set up. And so I'm going to show you how, using Mono.NET, we ended up supporting our CI builds as well. So let me flip over here to the Mac again, and I think it probably locked. All right, good. Let's close this down. And we published everything to Git, so let's go ahead and not open the App Store. Let's go to GitHub and pull this down. So we'll grab this. Git clone. All right, so the first thing that I want to kind of highlight here is I'm going to open Sublime here so that I can make some edits. There's a couple of differences. In this case, actually, I'm only going to highlight one, but the CS proj, there's one thing that we're going to end up having to change on our project file so that XBuild, which is kind of the open source equivalent to MSBuild, can end up compiling our projects correctly. And I have a feeling that future versions of Mono.NET someone will resolve the differences so that you don't end up having to do this each time. But for this to compile, what we need to do is change some paths so that when it tries to do the NuGet restore, it knows where to get these packages, right? So I'm going to come into our salesforce.force csproj file. And by the way, figuring all this out the first time took a long time, so I feel proud that I can just show you guys how to do this and it works. So I'm going to update all these references for our NuGets just to look down one level. Otherwise, it just has no idea where to find the referenced assemblies. So this is really the only somewhat hacky thing we need to do. Making that change now, Mono.NET does a pretty good job of actually building and running all this stuff. So what I'm going to do now is grab a bunch of scripts, and I'll show you these. But we're going to use these scripts, and what we're going to do is we're going to do NuGet package restores here on the Mac. We're going to then do an X build against our solution to build all our projects, and that will also end up building our functional and our unit tests. And then we're going to end up using a NUnit test runner to actually run through all our tests. So essentially what we're doing now is we have the full ability to compile and test all of our stuff here on the Mac, which I think is pretty fantastic. So I'm going to create this folder called CI, and we're going to use that in a moment. I'm just going to copy some assets that I have here already to our CI folder. And then I mentioned NuGet package restore. How many of you in Visual Studio have gone on the solution, and I think it's on the solution, enabled package restore so that next time a developer opens it, it builds and grabs it? You know, I saw a couple hands. It's a great resource. It makes it really easy. But what I found is that it actually causes some problems down the line when you try to use the solutions on a non-developer environment. Because if you, let's say you deploy out and you're running in the cloud or in some service, you know, it doesn't have Visual Studio, and it doesn't end up enabling that package restore the same way. So on our SDK, I don't end up enabling package restore on any of the projects. What I end up doing is I do this a little bit differently. I actually use the NuGet executable, and I initiate a restore on it. So let me show you what that looks like. So one of the files I copied over was this NuGet config. Let me see if I can, how do I bump this? I'm not particularly good at Macs, so I apologize. I don't know how to increase that. This NuGet.config file, what it tells us a couple of different things when we end up doing a restore. You can see the package sources. So it's pointing to the official NuGet API, right? So now we know where to find NuGet packages from. And it does some other things as well. And it says sets enabled to true and automatic to true. So we can set some properties there. Now, when we eventually run this script, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to call NuGet.exe. You may not have seen this, but when I copied the assets over, in the CI folder, you can see there's a NuGet.exe. That's actually the NuGet executable that you can find up on, I'm forgetting the name of the repository, but Microsoft's, on the NuGet code page, you can download NuGet.exe. So we're going to be calling that from Mono. So you can see we're executing Mono. We're pointing to our NuGet executable. We're saying do a restore, pointing to our config file. We're setting a few other pieces of information. Like I like to see a detailed report in case there's problems. I don't want it to cache. I want to make sure that it's grabbing the NuGet. And I also don't have it run it in parallel. So this way, when we first start running our script, we're actually going to get all the NuGet assemblies, all the NuGets and all the assemblies we need before we even try to do our build. So then we'll do our build. And then the last thing we want to do is execute our unit tests here locally. And I use something called, it's a NuGet package called nunit.runners. And inside nunit.runners, it actually has this executable, this nunit-console.executable. So it gives us the ability now to install that NuGet package and then use Mono to execute that console, that nunit console. And you can see here at the end, we pass in a parameter, and that parameter is our assembly. So let me pull all this together. So we're going to create this new file. We're going to call it run tests. And it's a shell script, so .sh. And here's what it looks like. So we're saying that it's an executable shell script. We're going to first call package restore, and we're passing our solution to it. We're going to run xbuild, and we're going to compile the solution. So it's going to build all of our assemblies. And then we're running that new nunit script, and we're going to pass to it the DLL, the assembly name. And when we do this, it should run all from the console. So let's flip over. And we need to just change and make this executable. So let's do that and then run it. So fingers, cannot locate the solution file. So it looks like, what did I get wrong? Source, Salesforce. Okay, I'm sorry. You know what? I forgot one step before. The solution file, for whatever reason, and I do not like this, ends up saving in the project directory. So let me just update that real quick. It's a fast change. So we'll change that. And then, sorry, you can't see what I'm doing. I didn't flip over. I'm just doing a quick update. All right. So now if I do a git pull, you see all I did is I moved the solution file. You can see now the salesforce.force.solution is there. So apologies about that. Let's try to run this now. All right, so it's running. You can see the green is actually doing a call out to NuGet. It's grabbing the NuGet packages. Now xbuild is running, and it's building our solution, and it's creating all those assemblies. And then this last part you can see here, and I'll scroll back, you can see it's actually running our unit tests. So here we did a test run of our, here's our auth underscore username underscore has token. And then down here, we ran the auth underscore has API version, and both of those passed. So pretty easily, we were able to take the project that we built on our PC in Visual Studio, pulled it over to our Mac, and using Mono, we were able to compile it and confirm that this is working. So I think that's pretty neat. And I think developers that end up using the SDK appreciate just those little things that are done in order to enable that support. So now I just want to set up our continuous integration. I'm using Travis. You can use whatever you choose to. But what's nice about Travis is I can essentially enable this by pointing it to our GitHub repository. So I'm just going to do a sync so that it sees our new project and grab it. And if we come down, here's our TechEd 14 SDK. We'll turn that on. And then let's go ahead and commit. Updated for Mono and Travis. Now, for Travis to process this, we need to give it some instructions. So I'm going to grab another file called travis.yaml, and we'll take a quick look at this. Basically, it's very similar to the run test script that we created. We're going to just tell it to enable package restore. We're telling it which version of Mono we want to use. And then we have a before install command. Now, Travis uses a bunch of just Linux VMs in order to run, so it doesn't necessarily have Mono installed. So we're going to first download the right version of Mono, and this is just a package that we're going to download. And it's important to note we're downloading the MDK. The MDK actually has some of the underlying .NET NuGet packages we'll need in order to get this stuff to compile properly. And then we just do sudo install, and we install the package. And then we just run the same scripts here that we ran in that run test shell script. So that's all this file is. So let's go ahead and add this. And then we'll push it. Oops. All right. So we've pushed this up there now. Now, the one thing I'll say, and it takes a few moments, so we'll come back to this in our demo. Travis, it essentially queued up that build process, right? So we'll see it in a couple of moments. But what it's going to look like is very much like this test here, where a worker starts and it runs through and runs the same script. So you can see the same sort of things happening, right? It does a package restore first, does the xbuild, runs through our unit tests, and then it exits. And if it exits zero at the end, you know that you have a passing build. And so this is a very nice way with every commit to validate and verify that your build is actually compiling and working. So, great, so we've got this going. We'll come back to Travis a little bit later to see how it's doing. And now let's move on to some other topics. So the next thing is anonymous types and dynamics. So Salesforce has, in our REST API, a very flexible way to interact with what we call objects. And an object could be something like an account with a bunch of account information in it. It could be a custom object that you create. It could be widgets. And it's all done declaratively, and it's all stored declaratively in our platform. While that's really, really nice, what's hard is creating a set of methods that can be used regardless of the type of object that you want to interact with. So let's say you want to create a method that lets you query. Well, the question is, are you going to create a method that is strongly typed and interacts with every single object that's out there? In Salesforce, this could be hundreds of objects, so that's not a very sustainable model to use. Instead, what we use is something called anonymous types. And so we'll actually define our method, our query method, and we'll do this in a moment, in a way where we tell the developer to instruct us as to what the type is that we're working with. And this works really well with our API, and presumably yours and other APIs as well, so that you don't have to dictate what it is that the users are doing. At the same time, we end up returning a bunch of JSON. And since these objects, again, there could be hundreds of objects and they could be custom objects, we also don't want to necessarily have to type everything so that with the return response, we're serializing this JSON into this strongly typed object that we have already previously created. So we want to make sure that our SDK makes it easy for people to leverage dynamics when they interact with it. So let me show you what we did and how we can do this with our SDK that we're building. So now that we've got our authentication client built, let's create what's called a force, we'll call it the force client, and this will be how we can query and get information from Salesforce. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to pull all the updates that I made on the Mac and reload a few things, but it should still build, and you can see it still builds successfully. I'm now going to create a new class. We're going to call this Force Client. And this will be a public class. Yes. All right, so I'm going to save a little bit of time here as we proceed and build out some of these things a little more quickly. So we have two constructors here. And we give some flexibility for the user so they can pass in or use instance URL, and this comes from our authentication client, our access token and our API version. And they can either let us construct the HTTP client for them, or they can pass it in. Regardless, this constructor is going to be called, and you can see we have a couple of things that we're doing to the header here. The first is we're actually going to attach the access token as our bearer token. And this is added to the request header and is used by our API to validate that you have the ability to do what it is you're trying to do. So we add that bearer token. And then we're also just going to tell it that we're going to be interacting with JSON as well. So we put this in the constructor so that it's there, we construct the force client, and we don't have to worry about it again. So now let's go ahead and create our query method. Now, there's a little bit more going on here, so I'll explain what we're doing. Again, this is asynchronous. Whereas before we were largely just returning task, now we're returning task of a particular type. And so essentially, we're going to return what's called this query result object that we need to build. And it is going to actually be a query result of type T. And we'll show that type T is going to be that anonymous type that we want to use. And again, the idea here is we're going to be returning a bunch of records that they've queried, and we don't necessarily know what the type is. So we want the developer to pass us the type. Or they can use dynamics and just pass us the dynamic type, and it'll all get figured out by the .NET compiler. So here we've got our query async of type T, and I'll show you how this works in a moment. And we're going to have a suffix that is going to be appended to our request, and that's going to be query, Q equals, and then whatever our query statement is. And we're going to use all of this various pieces of information to construct the URL, so our instance URL, the API version, and the suffix. And then we're going to create our request in a pretty standard way. Now, when we get a response, it's going to be JSON. So we're going to use Newtonsoft to handle that. And then we're going to get another error response here. So let me go ahead and I believe this should be 10. I don't know, but it's OK. And show you what we've got. So this is pretty powerful. And it was eye-opening for me when I saw what we could do with it. So the query result of type T is, again, what we pass into, or excuse me, what we return from our query async. And so the reason we do this is when we return back a query, we return not just all the records, but some additional information. And so you can see here, we have a next records URL. Well, we do that so that we don't want to return to you 2 million records. We want to return 1,000 at a time. But you may want to see those, the rest of those queries. So we give you essentially a way to continue. It's a continuation URL that you can use to make your next call against so that you can get the next 1,000 and the next 1,000 and the next 1,000. And that's part of the top level, element that's returned as part of the JSON response. We also tell you the total size, so that way you can see that you got 1,000 records in your list. But you let's say, have 10,000 something, right? So now you know that you need to do some subsequent queries to get them all. We return back done to tell you if it's completed or not. And then also, we return back the list. Now notice that list is of type T. And so what this means is when we call query async, we can pass in dynamic or that type. And we're essentially telling it that when I pass in a particular type to query async, we're going to use that, we're going to deserialize to it, but then we're going to return back this query results that's going to include a collection of records that are of list type T. So hopefully that's clear. As we write the code, it should, I think, become clearer if it's not. But it's, a pretty powerful way to look at creating this flexible SDK. All right, so we've got our query async created, but we want to run it. So let's create another functional test. So we'll just use the same project we had before. and we'll say public async task. And this time, let's call it query counts is not null. All right, and so actually, we'll just save time. I'll copy this. All right, and then I'll say client equals new force client. Now, the force client, remember the constructor takes some information. So this information is part of our authentication client. So we'll pass it the instance URL, we'll pass it the access token, and we'll pass it the API version. And now let's get some results. We're going to await it because it's asynchronous. Client, query async. Now, this is where our anonymous types are so valuable. Because let's say we want to return accounts. You could create a new class, accounts class, and create properties for the values. But what's really nice is being able to use dynamic and essentially let it figure it out. And then we'll pass in the query. So ID, name, description from account. So that's our query. It's going to come back into results. Now remember, the results includes not just the actual records, but other stuff. So let's then create a new accounts variable, and this will end up being results.records. And so now we can do assert is not null accounts. And I'll put a breakpoint, we'll run this, and if it all works, then we should see some accounts. Here we've got 1,000 records. Again, my particular org, I have a bunch of test data in there, so there's more than 1,000, but it only returns 1,000 at a time. And you can see here, I've got all my accounts, so all these test accounts, different descriptions, and so forth. So our query works. And what's really nice is, again, that dynamic typing that's available. I don't have to specify what my type is when I end up calling that query async. Very, very powerful. If we look at the results, you can end up seeing some of that other information, right? Here, done is false, and it's not done because there's additional things for us to query. Here's the next records URL, so I could end up calling to that and get the next 1,000 records, and so on and so forth. So you can see, actually, I only have 76 additional records to go. But our test passed, so that's great. And what's really nice about all this is now I can add this. Let's commit it. Added query. Push it. Let's flip over to our Mac. Let's pull it. And let's run our tests. And we can immediately get some verification to see if this ends up working here with the mono.net as well. And it does. So you can see right here, it called query accounts is not null, and it passed. So that's really good. While I'm here now, though, let's go ahead and look back at Travis. And I have no control over the service, so if it's updated, great. If not, you'll just have to take my word for it. And it did, look. So here we go. We've got, this was the first commit that we made, so what we made before. And you can see it ran through. The build is passing, and it's everything that we expect to see, right? We exited with zero, which is good. I did just do a commit, so if I hit build history, you can see right now it's actually running live. So when I did the commit from my PC, it actually committed it to GitHub. Travis is watching my repository, and so it kicked off this build. And so it's going to just go ahead and build it, and you can see it run. It'll take a couple minutes because it has to download the MDK package and so forth and then install it. But I think it's a pretty good demonstration of it in action. All right. So the last, well, I'm sorry, this isn't the last. The next segment I want to talk about is NuGet. So we built this, hopefully you think it's this just fantastic library, an SDK, but right now someone would have to either clone it or download the code and attach it or compile it and grab the assemblies and so forth, and that's kind of inconvenient. So we want to leverage NuGet in order to make it really easy for developers to consume our SDK. It's actually pretty simple. We're going to use the same NuGet executable that we used for the restore before, so we've already got our NuGet executable. And now what we're going to end up doing is we're going to create a NuGet specification file, a NuSpec file, that's going to describe our NuGet package. It's going to define an ID. It's going to version it. It's going to specify dependencies. And then we're going to use that NuSpec file to actually create the actual NuGet package. And then we're going to push that package up to NuGet so that other people can download it. NuGet is fantastic. Now, it does in my mind two things that are really good. One is it manages dependencies really, really well. So if I'm using, you know, in this particular case, if you install the Force client, you're going to get with it the Microsoft.net.http NuGet packages, you know, all the BCLs, the BCL sync, all that kind of stuff. And you're going to end up getting the Newtonsoft JSON.NET libraries. So it chains all those dependencies really well and makes it a lot easier for us to, you know, not have to juggle through, you know, assemblies and all the different things we're trying to do. The other thing that it does really well is versioning. So when we deploy our NuGet package, we can version it, and we can continually increment that version so that and we can actually control the visibility of those versions as well, so that we, you know, let developers use the one that we want them to use, while also keeping the older ones still available if they're needed for backwards compatibility perspective. So let's flip over and look at this. So for time's sake, I created a new spec file. So let's just copy that local, and we'll take a look at it. So here's the new spec file. Hopefully you guys can see it. You can actually use NuGet to create the new spec, like a starter NuGet new spec file. I find that I typically just end up going back to ones I've created before. You can find them in my GitHub repos or a bunch of other people's. But basically, the important elements are going to be these IDs. And let's just switch this to XML so that it looks a little bit better. So IDs, version. This is how you're going to manage versioning of your NuGet package. Some of your URLs so that you can point people to the right place, description, and then dependencies is very important. So you want to make sure that you describe what your NuGet package and what your libraries are dependent on. And then as important are going to be the files that you include in it. And so here you can see I'm including if you're launching this into production, you probably don't want to use debug. But for now, I'm using the debug assemblies. I'm also including the PDBs so that people could potentially get the symbols. And then I'm also including all the CS files. That way, you know, people could, you know, use some of the symbols and the files to actually debug things if they needed to. So the only thing I'm going to update is the repo name, because I didn't know what I was going to call it. So let's update that. All right. And then let's build it. So again, I said that I have NuGet in the CI folder. We're going to use pack, and then we're going to pass it the new spec file. And that's going to create our NuGet package. So if we take a look now, oops, you'll see that we have this long new PKJ file. So what we're going to do is, before we push it, because once you push, you can't actually delete. That's one of the things that the NuGet team has done, is you have to contact support if you want something deleted. The reason for that is, as you continue to version things, someone else may be dependent on an older version of yours, and you don't want to break their build. So you don't want to test by pushing to NuGet and then testing. You want to test locally. So the way I do that is, and actually just about everyone else as well, I would imagine, is you can set up your folder where your NuGet package is as a source for NuGet files. So we're going to come to the NuGet package manager, to settings, and sources. And you can see I've got this local value specified. Let's just update it with our new directory. And so now what I'll do is I'll create a brand new project. Let's create a console app this time. And I'm not going to build the library this time. I'm going to use it. So let's go ahead and install our package. So install package, I'm going to point to local, which is that local repository I set up. And you'll see there is wadewagner.salesforce.force. So we'll install that. See all the dependencies come through. If I check references, you'll see that the salesforce.force assembly is there and everything else I need. And so now we can write it. Let's just go to our unit test here. Let's just grab this guy. We'll have to modify the code a little bit, but not too much. And let's grab these guys. And all right, we'll add the using statement for it. Now, the thing to note about a console app, and I did this purposely because I want to demonstrate that, you know, console main doesn't like to do things asynchronously in main. So we can rewrite this code a little bit so that it works. So instead of awaiting it, I'm going to end up doing calling our method .wait. And so that will cause us to wait as we interact with the user, username password async. And then instead of awaiting here, what I'm going to do is var results equals our query async, and I'm going to go results.wait. And then you'll see that records doesn't work, and that's because we now have to say our result.records. So just a little bit of rewriting here, right, for, you know, in a console app. If you were to use this in a Windows Phone app, you'd do it like I did in that first demo, if you remember all the way back then, where, you know, we didn't have to use this kind of syntax. We were able to await it as we'd expect. But I just want to show you that it works in both ways. And now we can just, you know, console.writeline accounts. We can just say count. And so that's all we're writing now to interact. Let's go ahead and run this, and we should see 1,000. And we see 1,000. So basically, I mean, and gosh, what, the last 60 minutes, you know, from nothing, we've ended up building an SDK that, you know, we've been able to package up in a NuGet package and, oops, facilitate our development against the API. Of course, the last step here would be now to do NuGet dot, oops, sorry, NuGet dot exe push, and then our NuGet package. I'm not going to do that again because, you know, I'm not going to maintain the Wade Wegner dot Salesforce dot force library up in NuGet. But I think you get the idea. So we push it, and all would be good. So pretty powerful. I'm not done yet. One last set of things to talk about. And I actually don't have any demos for this. Actually, maybe I do. But I think this is a very important topic, important things to talk through. We'll start with community. If you plan to build an open source project, it's very important that you are present and you don't just build something, throw it out there, and abandon it. There's a lot of things that I've built in the past where I've done that, and I'll tell you they're not very relevant or very helpful today. So when I started building this Salesforce SDK as an open source project, I was, you know, I committed myself to, you know, staying very active with it and continuing to be relevant as part of it. As a consequence, just in the last 3-4 months that it's been public, I've seen a lot of activity. Not just, you know, bugs that have been identified, and there's been a few, but people getting excited and actually cloning or forking the repository, making additions to it, and then committing it back. And that wouldn't have happened if people didn't see me actively continuing to work on that. And what I mean by active is not just committing stuff, but actually, you know, creating documentation, so markdown files that provide some tutorials that show people how to use it. You know, when I keep track of my to-do list, I will do that publicly in the issues up in GitHub and so forth. So I think in order to build community around these things, you really need to stay active and relevant as part of it. Otherwise, other people won't end up supporting it as well. Now, license, I'm not going to spend too much time talking about license, but it's one of the first things you're going to have to determine when you end up creating your repository. I work for a relatively large organization that has a legal department, so my license choice was very easy. I asked our legal department, and so we use BSD Clause 3. There's a number of reasons for it, but essentially this allows us to share the code. People can use it as long as they attribute it properly, right? You may have other requirements. There may be other things that you at your company care about, so you'll want to take a look at some of the licenses. Personally, I use Apache. There's a lot of great licenses out there, but I mention this just so that you think about this ahead of time, because it's something that'll end up being important, something that you'll end up, you know, if you choose the wrong one or you don't choose one, you may be sorry for later. GitHub and other places do a great job of providing you a place for you to publicly keep track of issues and features and bugs, and I strongly encourage you to use it. I keep track of feature requests, bugs, issues, all that stuff publicly. When I think of something new I want to do, I will add it as an issue, I'll mark it as a feature request, I'll sign it to myself, and hopefully I'll get to it quickly. Other people can do the same. And the last is pull requests. I think the best part about open source is actually collaborating in open source. Not just, you know, making it my source code available to you, but having you guys participate in this creation with me and enabling, you know, new features or fixing things. And so I'm pretty happy. In the last 3-4 months, we've had, I don't know, 2 to 3 dozen pull requests, all of which I'll say are feature additions. No bug fixes, which is kind of nice. But these are people adding additional functionality to the SDK that I built, which is fantastic. And I think everything that I mentioned above this plays into that. The community that you build and you're a part of, the license that you choose, as well as how you use issues, features, and bugs. So, you know, I think maybe the only thing I'll show is not so much of a demo, but, you know, back on our GitHub repo here, and this is the official SDK, you'll end up seeing that, you know, we've got a lot of, so we've had 23, so about 2 dozen, you know, pull requests. One thing that's kind of nice is that Travis CI build is fully integrated, so when people end up initiating a pull request, you can see if it passes the test, your test, which is pretty nice. You'll see that we've got issues. Some of them are enhancements. Some of them aren't yet categorized, but you get the idea. And then, of course, the license that you choose and so forth. So just giving a quick overview of it, things that you should think of when building out your SDK. So... wrong one. So with that, you know, we'll review what we've talked about, and hopefully this was digestible and wasn't too fast, and you know, you got something out of it. But we went through a lot of different things here, and I hope the creating from scratch approach worked well. I find that if I see something being built, it sticks a lot more than just seeing it already built. But we went through PCLs and the importance of them to target multiple platforms, the extensibility so that, you know, you're not dictating how people use your SDK, but you give them some flexibility as to how they want to use the SDK. Making things asynchronous so that you can use them not only multiple platforms, but you don't get blocking and so forth. Functional and unit tests, I think, are key. They're table stakes. They're not nice-to-haves. They are table stakes. Model.net, you saw how easy it was to get, you know, cross-platform support with CI, the importance of anonymous types, so that you don't have to manage all these strongly typed things that exist in the world. Dynamics is a part of that, NuGet, and everything else we just talked about around community and so forth. So that's the talk, so thank you very much. Call to action, I would be tickled if you took a little bit closer look at the Salesforce SDK and toolkits. Go up to the GitHub repo, there's a lot of resources there. What I built here is by no means the same. It's very similar. You'll see a lot of things there, but you know, the full SDK is by far a lot more extensive. So if you want to see, you know, even more and something more mature, take a look at the GitHub repo. Build something. I think Scott Hanselman has a great call to action when it comes to open source. If you haven't seen it, go to his blog and take a look at it. I've been inspired by it. Go build things. Go contribute to projects. And engage in the open source community. So thank you very much. I appreciate you attending. Please do, when you get a chance, submit an evaluation. I want you to win an Xbox One, and I'd also like to get your feedback. So thank you guys very much. If you have any questions, by all means, feel free to ask them or come on up. So thanks.